You're listening to the mighty KYRS Thin Air Community Radio, 88.1 and 92.3 FM, and streaming around the world on KYRS.org.
You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Praxis receives support from Puffin Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories. 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffinglassstudios.com. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. The program is Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I will be playing some historical and more modern speeches of amazing, inspirational, revolutionary person, Angela Davis, and also sharing with you some older work read by me. Because I don't believe there is a recorded version from Audre Lorde. It is Black History Month, obviously, and while I think ideas like that, I talked about this last March during, which is Women's History Month, about how months like that can come off as, can be tokenizing, I think, as can a lot of expressions about diversity that misunderstand the real purpose of diversity and understanding it and understanding history. I want to do that in a genuine way and share some of the reflections by revolutionary Black women about these topics. So rather than me do it without having that experience, I will amplify that for you. Hopefully learn something about history you don't know yet. So I wanted to start with a couple quotes and then kind of move in. There's so much happening regarding race. The conversation about race in the U.S. Is finally exciting again. It's still very discouraging in a lot of ways, especially when talking to white middle America, you know, because there's so little understanding about it. And I really hope that more people can have these light bulb moments similar to the ones that I had, particularly when exposed to certain parts of Black history and certain thinkers. These two women I'm going to share with you being having primary roles in that process. So these are two quotes from Audre Lorde that I'm going to start with. The first is, "The learning process is something you can incite, literally incite, like a riot." And I just think that's inspirational because that's what learning does for you. It sets off this chain reaction of, well, if that's true or if that's not true in a lot of cases, you know, talking about learning a lot of these ideas, people are resistant to because when they learn the truth or the full story, the uglier side of history, there's a defense reaction much of the time. And but if you can get beyond the defensiveness of it, it can be a very exciting chain reaction that happens. Well, if that's a lie, maybe all these other things are a lie. And then you end up a crazy person like me going, oh no, it's the whole system. Everything's wrong. Let's change everything. Let's uproot it and start over. As she said, incited like a riot. And this quote really dovetails with that, also from Lord, being the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. And that is a potent concept and one that can be really difficult for people. And it's a conclusion that I've really come to share. The more I study politics, the more I speak with activists and thinkers of all stripes, the most effective solutions are the ones that are not offered to you as a solution by people in power. And that's just a big fact. But part of this tokenizing of the idea of diversity is about keeping that truth, keeping the idea of the master's tools not dismantling the master's house from coming to light. I think a lot of the success that we're shown, or that we're told to look for as women, both of these women today are strident feminists, outspoken feminist thinkers. I obviously am a feminist as well, if you listen to the show. And also from a race perspective, really resist this idea of assimilating into the dominant culture, which has abused you systematically. When I hear women, mostly it's already wealthy white women who promote this idea, some wealthy black women do as well, saying that we'll achieve equality when we have as many female CEOs as male CEOs, overlooking the idea that that whole design is a patriarchal domination style design that perpetuating it doesn't really help women as a category. So I think the people we're told to look to are people who didn't rock the boat too much, who rocked the boat just enough, but you know, not too much to really learn about. When we learn about Martin Luther King Jr. in school, we learn the obviously inspirational story of working on civil rights domestically, but most people I know don't hear the Beyond Vietnam speech, for instance, which I've played on the show before. They don't hear about his very radical anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist ideas, because they're not part of this idea of assimilating into the American dream. It's been whitewashed, no pun intended, to a great deal. But the value of actual diversity is huge, but it also threatens the monolithic systems that we have in place, whether they be white supremacy, patriarchy, heteronormativism, not the right word. Because in true diversity, you have not just different colored people sitting around a boardroom, as you'll see if you, you know, Google image the term diversity. You don't just have all the right ingredients at the table visually, but you have a diversity of culture, a diversity of thoughts, a diversity of approaches to the world, a diversity of tactics that people think will be effective in making change. And that's a lot messier, but it also works much better and allows for creativity and movement and actual change. And that is not on the agenda of, I think, people who have power and people who benefit from the current power structure and haven't developed a critique of it. So this idea of real diversity, amplifying all the voices that we can hear. When I was first introduced to some of the writing and ideas from the Black Panther Party, for instance, which was my introduction to Angela Davis, who I'll be sharing some of her speeches with you later in the hour, both modern and from the past. She was recently at WSU actually and spoke there, which I could not go to. But I was shocked at how diverse the tactics were and how much more there was to the story than the kind of like Forrest Gump caricature that I had received in school. You get a very simplified version of, you know, oh, they were violent, Martin Luther King was peaceful. And it's so much more complicated than that, and so much more interesting, and really, just really triggered a lot of things for me. So I want to share some of these quotes and ideas with you, and honor both of these women because they're awesome, and there's so many more stories we can learn from. I just read an article today by a younger black woman who talked about her development in going from, she was in a mostly white kind of elite school in the South growing up in secondary school, and was always pushing in her honors classes to go a little deeper on Black history and contribution to art and everything, and was consistently told, oh, there's just not that much to learn. And she knew that was wrong because she had read widely about it and said, no, there is more. Let's learn about it. And when she finally got beyond that level of schooling, really learning more about Black history, She didn't realize until much later that that learning had still focused on the men and the men's voices of that movement. So it's kind of a step toward what she needed. And then, you know, eventually she gets to the women and this intersection of feminism, anti-racism, all of the delightful things she's interested in for, you know, furthering the human project. And just talked about how kind of she felt cheated when she discovered all of this wealth of information that was out there that she hadn't been exposed to, even as someone who was looking. So if nothing else, you know, this month and just in your life, just go look for some new information you didn't know about. And I think that'd be great. So this is a longer piece by Audre Lorde also, The Transformation of Silence into Language and Action. And I would like to read it for you now. So this is a speech that she gave in the late 70s, early 80s. The version I'm going to share with you is the one that appeared in the Cancer Journals, published in 1980 by Spinsters Press, a great name for a publishing house. I would like to preface my remarks on the transformation of silence into language and action with a poem. The title of it is A Song for Many Movements, and this reading is dedicated to Winnie Mandela. Winnie Mandela is a South African freedom fighter who is in exile somewhere in South Africa. She had been in prison and had been released and was picked up again after she spoke out against the recent jailing of black schoolchildren who were singing freedom songs and who were charged with public violence. A Song for Many Movements. Nobody wants to die on the way and caught between ghosts of whiteness and the real water. None of us wanted to leave our bones on the way to salvation. Three planets to the left, a century of light years ago. Our spices are separate and particular, but our skins sign in complementary keys. At 7:45 mean time, we were telling the same stories over and over and over. Broken down gods survive in the crevices and mud pots of every beleaguered city, where it is obvious there are too many bodies to cart to the ovens or gallows, and our uses have become more important than our silence after the fall. Too many empty cases of blood to bury or burn. There will be nobody left to listen, and our labor has become more important than our silence. Our labor has become more important than our silence. I have come to believe over and over again that what is most important to me must be spoken, made verbal or shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood, that the speaking profits me beyond any other effect. I'm standing here as a black lesbian poet, and the meaning of all that waits upon the fact that I'm still alive and might not have been. Less than 2 months ago, I was told my two doctors, one female and one male, that I would have to have breast surgery, and that there was a 60 to 80% chance that the tumor was malignant. Between the telling and the actual surgery, there was a 3-week period of the agony and involuntary reorganization of my entire life. The surgery was completed, and the growth was benign. But within those 3 weeks, I was forced to look upon myself and my living with a harsh and urgent clarity that has left me still shaken but much stronger. This is a situation faced by many women, by some of you here today. Some of what I experienced during that time has helped elucidate for me much of what I feel concerning the transformation of silence into language and action. In becoming forcibly and essentially aware of my own mortality and of what I wished and wanted for in my life, however short it might be, priorities and omissions became strongly etched in a merciless light, and what I most regretted were my silences. Of what had ever I been afraid? To question or to speak as I believed would have meant pain or death, but we all hurt in so many different ways all the time, and the pain will either change or end. Death, on the other hand, is the final silence, and that might be why coming quickly now, without regard for whether I had ever spoken what needed to be said, or only betrayed myself into small silences, while I planned someday to speak, or waited for someone else's words. And I began to recognize a source of power within myself that comes from the knowledge that while it is most desirable not to be afraid, learning to put fear into a perspective gave me great strength. I was going to die, if not sooner than later, whether or not I had ever spoken myself. My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you. But for every real word spoken, for every attempt I had ever made to speak those truths for which I am still seeking, I had made contact with other women while we examined the words to fit a world in which we all believed, bridging our differences. And it was the concern and caring of all those women which gave me strength and enabled me to scrutinize the essentials of my living. The women who sustained me through that period were black and white, old and young, lesbian, bisexual, and heterosexual, and we all shared a war against the tyrannies of silence. They all gave me a strength and concern without which I could not have survived intact. Within those weeks of acute fear came the knowledge. Within the war we are all waging with the forces of death, subtle and otherwise, conscious or not, I am not only a casualty, I am also a warrior. What are the words you do not have yet? What do you need to say? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them, still in silence? Perhaps for some of you here today, I am the face of one of your fears, because I am a woman, because I am black, because I am myself, a black woman warrior poet doing my work, come to ask you, are you doing yours? And of course I'm afraid. You can hear it in my voice, because the transformation of silence into language and action is an act of self-revelation, and that always seems fraught with danger. But my daughter, when I told her of our topic and my difficulty with it, said, "Tell them about how you're never really a whole person if you remain silent, because there's always that one little piece inside of you that wants to be spoken out, and if you keep ignoring it, it gets madder and madder and hotter and hotter, and if you don't speak it out one day, it will just up and punch you in the mouth." On the cause of silence, each one of us draws her own fear. Fear of contempt, of censure, of some judgment or recognition, of challenge, of annihilation. But most of all, I think we fear the visibility without which we also cannot truly live. Within this country where racial difference creates a constant, if unspoken, distortion of vision, black women have on one hand always been highly visible, and so on the other hand have been rendered invisible through the depersonalization of racism. Even within the women's movement, we have had to fight, and still do, for that very visibility which also renders us most vulnerable, our blackness. For to survive in the mouth of this dragon we call America, we have had to learn this first and most vital lesson, that we were never meant to survive, not as human beings, and neither were most of you here today, black or not. And that visibility, which makes you most vulnerable, is also our greatest strength. Because the machine will try to grind us into dust anyway, whether or not we speak. We cannot sit in our corners mute forever, while our sisters and ourselves are wasted, while our children are distorted and destroyed, while our earth is poisoned. We can sit in our safe corners as mute as bottles, and still we will be no less afraid. In my house this year, we are celebrating the Feast of Kwanzaa, the African-American Festival of Harvest, which begins the day after Christmas and lasts for 7 days. There are 7 principles of Kwanzaa, one for each day. The first principle is umoka, which means unity, the decision to strive for and maintain unity in the self and community. The principle for yesterday, the second day, was kujikajichagulia, self-determination, the decision to define ourselves, name ourselves, and speak for ourselves, instead of being spoken for by others. Today is the third day, and the principle for today is ujima, collective work and responsibility, the decision to build and maintain ourselves and communities together, and to recognize and solve our problems together. Each of us is here now because in one way or another, we share a commitment to language and to the power of language and to the reclaiming of that language which has been made to work against us. In the transformation of silence into language and action, it is vitally necessary to teach by living and speaking those truths which we believe and know beyond understanding, because in this way alone we can survive. By taking part in a process of life that is creative and continuing. That is growth. And it is never without fear of visibility, of the harsh light of scrutiny, and perhaps of judgment, of pain, of death. But we have lived through all of those already in silence, except death. And I remind myself all the time now that if I was to have been born mute, or had maintained an oath of silence my whole life long for safety, I would still have suffered, and I would still die. It is very good for establishing perspective. And where the words of women are crying to be heard, we must each of us recognize our responsibility to seek those words out, to read them and share them and examine them in their pertinence to our lives, that we not hide behind the mockeries of separations that have been imposed upon us and which so often we accept as our own. For instance, I can't possibly teach black women's writing. Their experience is so different than mine. Yet how many years have you spent teaching Plato and Shakespeare and Proust? Or another, "She's a white woman. What could he possibly have to say to me?" She. Or, "She's a lesbian. What would my husband say, or my chairman?" Or again, "This woman writes of her sons, and I have no children." and all the other endless ways in which we rob ourselves of ourselves and each other. We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid, in the same way we have learned to speak, work and speak when we are tired. For we have been socialized to respect fear more than our own needs for language and definition. And while we wait in silence for that final luxury of fearlessness, the weight of that silence will choke us. The fact that we are here and that I speak not these words is an attempt to break that silence and bridge some of those differences between us. For it is not difference which immobilizes us, but silence. And there are so many silences to be broken. So that, if you're just joining me, was The Transformation of Silence into Language and Action by Audre Lorde. Part of me sharing some things that have really inspired me through the years that are by two powerful, kick-ass Black women of American history, Audre Lorde and now Angela Davis next. The aspect of that last piece that I shared that I find so interesting is the hypocrisy of the way diversity can be presented. The end there where she talks about understanding other people's stories and the ways that those limitations are placed on us, despite the fact that many of us are not the generally wealthy, generally white, generally male people who have built the paradigm that we're living in. And yet we've adjusted everything about our, you know, emotional selves, our daily lives, our comfort to work around one idea of how life can be. And it's dangerous to build your culture and your society around one idea or one set of ideas. And it's painful. It causes great pain to everyone, including people who should perhaps, you know, based on social factors, feel comfortable in that role. Just like, you know, the idea of patriarchy hurting men in ways close to the scale of how it hurts women, a confining idea of masculinity is damaging. So, yeah, I really like that speech. I hope you did too. I don't know that there is a recorded version, but hopefully I did it some justice for you. This is a more recent piece from probably one of the most prolific scholars of the 20th and 21st centuries, Angela Davis, who since her years with the Black Panther Party and teaching during very tumultuous times in the late 60s through today when she still speaks and speaks on many issues, shows the intersectionality of these systems we're working to move beyond. She talks about imperialism as it relates to racism. She talks about racism being industrialized in the justice system, which is something we talked about last week, speaking about the death penalty. I'll be talking next week about militarism and post-traumatic stress. It's all on this continuum of violence. And if we can understand that, it becomes simpler, I think, at the end of the day to dismantle. If we understand that these are human behaviors that are not necessary to our humanity, and we can reject them all. So one thing, if you've been listening to the show through the last year, I've been talking quite a bit about Black Lives Matter as a movement, about the kind of newer face of civil rights organizing and anti-racism organizing. And if you are a long, long time listener to the show, you also know that I do a lot of solidarity work with people in Palestine, and that is a part of the world and an issue that's close to my heart, and that military occupation in its racist apartheid nature mimics a lot of other struggles we've seen in history, including in this country. And it was very both sad but also heartening and hopeful to see this Palestine to Ferguson hashtag that was happening during the clashes in Ferguson. You know, Palestinian activists sending advice over Twitter how to deal with tear gas, and multiple Black delegations from the U.S. going to Palestine and meeting and talking about the similarities and the differences in those two systems of racist oppression. So this is Angela Davis. This is from War on Want, talking about Palestine, the prison industrial complex, and much more. So this is kind of to say that while she's obviously a historical figure, she's still alive and well and with us and teaching and sharing, and that, you know, history is a living thing. It's still happening. It's not over. Many times it's, you know, taught in a strange order where we feel that it's something that's over and that doesn't affect our lives anymore. It's happening now. And you can feel free to insert yourself into the story at any time that you're ready. As Audre Lorde just said in the speech that I shared with you, transforming silence into language and action. So without further ado, I'm going to rest my voice and let Angela Davis do some of the talking for a while. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS if you've just joined me. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, feel free to send me an email, praxis@kyrs.org.
First of all, thank you for the wonderful welcome. And thank you, Brenna, for the great introduction. I see that I'm the professor this evening.
Sorry.
And also thank you, Rafif, and thank you, Frank. And thank you to everyone who came out this evening. This is an important meeting, in a sense, a major beginning. And I'm happy to see that so many people who are already involved in the campaign against G4S are present this evening as well. You inspire us to continue to work. When I was first asked to participate in this meeting highlighting the importance of boycotting the transnational security corporation G4S, I could not have known that this meeting would coincide with the death and memorialization of Nelson Mandela. And as I reflect on the legacies of struggle we associate with Mandela, I cannot help but recall the struggles that helped to forge the victory of his freedom, and thus the arena on which South African apartheid was dismantled. And as a result, I remember Ruth First and Joe Slovo, and I remember Walter and Albertina Sisulu and Govan Mbeki and Oliver Tambo and Chris Haney and so many others who are no longer with us. In keeping with Mandela's insistence of always locating himself within a context of collective struggle, it is fitting, I think, to evoke the names of others who played such an important role in the destruction of apartheid. And while it is moving to witness the unanimous and continued outpouring of praise for Nelson Mandela, I think we should also question the meaning of this sanctification. I know that he himself would have insisted on not being elevated to a kind of secular sainthood as a single individual, but would have always claimed space for his comrades in the struggle, and in this way would have seriously challenged the process of sanctification. He was indeed extraordinary, but as an individual, he was especially remarkable because he railed against the individualism that would single him out at the expense of those who were always at his side. And I think that his profound individuality resided precisely in his critical refusal to embrace the individualism that is such a central ideological component of neoliberalism. And so therefore, I want to take the opportunity to thank the countless numbers of people here in the UK, including the many then exiled members of the ANC and the South African Communist Party, who built a really powerful and exemplary anti-apartheid movement in this country. Having traveled here on numerous occasions during the 1970s and the 1980s to participate in a whole number of anti-apartheid events, I thank the women and men who were as unwavering in their commitment to freedom as was Nelson Mandela. And I'd like to say that participation in the solidarity movements here in the UK was so central to my own political formation, perhaps even more central than the movements that saved my life. And so as I mourn the passing of Nelson Mandela, I offer my deep gratitude to all of those who kept the anti-apartheid struggle alive for so many decades, for all the decades that it took to finally rid the world of apartheid. And I would like to evoke the spirit of the South African Constitution and its opposition to racism and anti-Semitism, as well as to sexism and homophobia. This is the context within which I would like to join with you once more to intensify campaigns against another regime of apartheid and in solidarity with the struggles of the Palestinian people. As Nelson Mandela said, we know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians. Mandela's political development took place within the context of an internationalism that always urged us to make connections among freedom struggles between the Black struggle in the southern United States and the African liberation movements, for example, conducted by, of course, the ANC in South Africa, but also the MPLA in Angola, in SWAPO in Namibia, in Frelimo in Mozambique, in PAIGC in Guinea-Bissau, in Cape Verde. And those solidarities were not only among people of African descent, but with Asian and Latin American struggles as well. Ongoing solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. And of course, solidarity with the people who were struggling against US military aggression in Vietnam. And so, almost a half century later, we have inherited the legacies of those solidarities, however well or badly specific struggles may have turned out, the solidarities were what produced hope and inspiration and helped to create real conditions to move forward. So now we're confronted with the task of assisting our sisters and brothers in Palestine as they battle against Israeli apartheid. Their struggles have many similarities with those against South African apartheid, one of the most salient being the ideological condemnation of their freedom efforts under the rubric of terrorism. And I understand that evidence is being made available that indicates historical collaboration between the CIA. Well, we knew the CIA collaborated with the South African apartheid regime, but it appears that it was a CIA agent who gave South African authorities the location of Nelson Mandela's whereabouts in 1962, and that led, of course, directly to his capture and imprisonment. And it wasn't until the year 2008, that's like 5 years ago, right? That his name was taken off of the terrorist watch list when George W. Bush, maybe you remember him, when George W. Bush signed a bill that finally removed him and other members of the ANC from the list. In other words, when Mandela visited the U.S. on several occasions after his release in 1990, he was still on the terrorist list, and there had to be the requirement that he be banned from the U.S. had to be expressly waived. The point that I'm making is that for a very long time, he and his comrades shared the same status as numerous Palestinians today. And that as the U.S. explicitly collaborated with the South African apartheid government, it supported and continues to support the Israeli occupation of Palestine, currently in the form of over $8.5 million a day in military aid. The occupation would not be possible without the collaboration of the U.S. government. And that is one of the messages we need to send to Barack Obama. It is, let me say, it's an honor to participate in this meeting, especially as one of the members of the International Political Prisoners Committee that was just recently formed in Cape Town, and also as a member of the jury of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. And of course, I'd like to thank War on Want for sponsoring this meeting, and SOAS, and particularly the progressive element here, for making it possible for us to be here this evening. This evening's gathering specifically focuses on the importance of expanding the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, which has been crafted in accordance with the powerful model of the anti-apartheid movement with respect to South Africa. While there are numerous transnational corporations that have been identified as targets of the boycott, Veolia, for example, and I know you know Veolia pretty well here, and there's SodaStream and Ahava and Caterpillar and Boeing and Hewlett-Packard, and I could go on and on, but I'll stop there. And I will also say that G4S is especially important because it participates blatantly, directly, openly in the maintenance and reproduction of repressive apparatuses in Palestine. We're talking about prisons and checkpoints and the apartheid wall. G4S represents the growing insistence on what is called security under the neoliberal state. And of course, Gina presented a critique of that notion of security by suggesting that feminist alternatives may be helpful as we attempt to reconceptualize what security should mean. The ideologies of security represented by G4S bolster not only the privatization of security, but the privatization of imprisonment, the privatization of warfare, as well as the privatization of healthcare and the privatization of education. G4S is responsible for the repressive treatment of political prisoners inside Israel and through the organization Ademir, which is directed by Sahar Francis, who's absolutely amazing. Some of you may have had the opportunity to hear her, but she travels all over the country and she provides us with information. She and her organization, Ademir, provide us with information about what is happening both inside the prisons and outside. We've learned about the terrifying universe of torture and imprisonment that is faced by so many Palestinians, but we've also learned about their spirit of resistance. We've learned about their hunger strikes and other forms of resistance that continue to take place behind the walls. I think Rafif may have pointed out that G4S is the third largest private corporation in the world. What is the first? What is the largest private corporation in the world? It's Walmart. And the number two is Foxconn, which produces devices like iPads and et cetera, et cetera. So I was looking at the website of G4S. It's really interesting to look at their self-representation, and they point out all of the things they protect. And among all of the objects of their protection are rock stars and sports stars and people and property. And I'm reading directly from the website, from ensuring that travelers have a safe and pleasant experience in ports and airports around the world. To secure detention and escorting of people who are not lawfully entitled to remain in a country. They tell you exactly what they're doing. And again, I'm quoting, in more ways than you might realize. G4S is securing your world. And we might add, in more ways that we might realize, G4S has insinuated itself into our lives under the guise of security and the security state, from the ways that Palestinians experience political incarceration and torture to racist technologies of separation and apartheid, from the wall in Israel to prison-like schools in the U.S. and the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. G4S Israel has brought sophisticated technologies of control to Hashron prison, which includes children among its detainees, and Damon prison, which incarcerates women as well. But let's look for a moment at the extent to which G4S is also involved in the what we might call the larger prison industrial complex. And I'm not referring to its involvement in prisons, and it runs and owns and operates private prisons all over the world. And if I still have time later, I'll talk about that. But I'm actually talking about schools. In the U.S., schools, particularly in poor communities, of color, are so thoroughly entangled with this prison industrial complex that sometimes we have a hard time distinguishing between schools and jails. You know, schools look like jails. And they use the same technologies detection, and they use oftentimes the same law enforcement officials. We have elementary schools in the U.S. that whose halls are actually patrolled by armed officers. And as a matter of fact, a recent trend has been to arm the teachers, particularly by school districts that cannot afford G4S. So if they cannot afford private security, then they teach their teachers how to shoot and give them guns. I kid you not. If you look at a website that is entitled Great Schools, and you look up a school in Florida that's called the Central Pasco Girls Academy in Land O'Lakes, Florida, you will only learn that it's a small alternative public school. But if you look at the facilities page of the G4S website, you will discover this entry: Central Pasco Girls Academy serves moderate risk females age 13 to 18 who have been assessed as needing intensive mental health services. And they go on to write about the way in which they use, quote, gender responsive services. And that they address sexual abuse and substance abuse, etc. Now, the reach of the prison industrial complex is far beyond the prison itself. And in that context, we might also think about other ways in which a firm like G4S is complicit with other aspects of Israel's system of apartheid. And the fact that it provides equipment and services to the checkpoints. It provides services at part that refer to part of the root of the illegal wall. And so forth and so on. And it's interesting that we see G4S along the wall in Israel, but we also see G4S providing transportation for deportees, and I'll talk about the UK in a moment, but I'm referring now to the transportation services that are used to usher undocumented immigrants from the U.S. to Mexico, thus colluding with the repressive immigration legislation and the practices inside the U.S. But of course, it was here in the U.K. where one of the most egregious acts of repression took place in the course of the transportation of an undocumented person. The last time I was in London, which actually wasn't that long ago, it was in October, and I was speaking at Birkbeck, and I had the opportunity to meet with Deborah Coles, who is a director at Inquest, and she told me about the case of Jimmy Mubenga. The inquest had happened last summer, and she explained how he had died, and this technique that was used by G4S employees to prevent his voice from being heard as he was being deported on a British Airways plane, and apparently he was handcuffed behind his back. He had a seatbelt on, and he was pushed by G4S people against the seat in front of him, and what they called a karaoke carpet. That is to say, he would have to sing into the carpet of the seat in front of him. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it, that they have this term for this form. Apparently, it was not supposed to be legal, but they were using it anyway. And he was restrained in that way for something like 40 minutes. And no one intervened. And of course, by the time there was an attempt to give him first aid, he was dead. And I think this egregious treatment of undocumented immigrants from the US to the UK compels us to make connections with Palestinians who are transformed into immigrants, indeed into undocumented immigrants, on their own land. And companies like G4S provide the technical means of carrying out this process. And then, of course, G4S is involved in the operation of prisons all over the world, including South Africa. And the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, recently spoke out against G4S, which runs a correctional center, the Mangaung Correctional Center in the Free State. Apparently, the occasion was the firing of something like 300 members of the police union because they went on strike. And let me read a brief passage from the COSATU statement. G4S's modus operandi is indicative of two of the most worrying aspects of neoliberal capitalism and Israeli apartheid: the ideology of security and the increasing privatization of what have been traditionally state-run sectors. Security in this context does not imply security for everyone, but rather, when one looks at the major clients of G4S security, banks, governments, corporations, etc., it becomes evident that when G4S says that it is securing your world, as the company's slogan goes, it is referring to a world of exploitation, repression, occupation, and racism. When I traveled to Palestine 2 years ago, and Gina pointed out that it was with a delegation of indigenous and women of color scholar activists. It was actually the first trip, the first visit to Palestine for all of us. And most of us had been involved for many years in Palestine solidarity work. But we were all totally shocked by the blatant nature of the repression associated with settler colonialism. The Israeli military made no attempt to conceal or even mitigate the character of the violence they were charged with inflicting on Palestinian people. Gun-carrying military men and women were everywhere, and some of them looked like they were only 13 years old. I know, as you get older, but look younger. But these were really young people walking around with huge guns. It was. I experienced it as a kind of nightmare. You know, and how can this be possible? The wall, the concrete, and the razor wire everywhere conveyed the impression that we were in prison. We were already in prison. And of course, as far as Palestinians were concerned, one misstep and that person could be arrested and hauled off to prison, from an open-air prison to a closed prison. G4S, it seems to me, represents these carceral trajectories that are so obvious in Palestine, but that increasingly characterize the profit-driven moves of transnational corporations associated with the rise of mass incarceration in the U.S. and in the world. In the U.S., there are some 2.5 million people in our country's jails and prisons and military prisons and jails in Indian country and immigrant detention centers. On any given day, that is to say, there are 2.5 million people approximately. It's a daily census, so it doesn't reflect the numbers of people who go through the system every week or every month or every year. The majority of those people are people of color. The fastest growing sector consists of women. Women of color. Many prisoners are queer and trans. As a matter of fact, trans people of color are the group most likely to be arrested and imprisoned. Racism provides the fuel for the maintenance, reproduction, and expansion of the prison industrial complex. And so if we say, as we do, abolish the prison industrial complex, we should also say abolish apartheid and end the occupation of Palestine. When we have in the States describe the segregation in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, that so clearly mirrors the historical apartheid of racism in the southern United States of America, especially when we talk about this to black people, the response is often, why hasn't anyone told us about this before? You know, why hasn't anyone told us about the signs in occupied Palestine and about the segregated express auto highways? Why hasn't anyone told us this before? And so, just as we say never again with respect to the fascism that produced the Holocaust, we should also say never again with respect to apartheid in South Africa, in the southern U.S. But that means, first and foremost, that we will have to expand and deepen our solidarities with the people of Palestine, people of all genders and sexualities, people inside and outside prison walls, inside and outside the apartheid wall. Boycott G4S, support BDS, and finally, Palestine will be free. Thank you.
All right, you've been listening to Praxis on KYRS, right up to the buzzer there, sharing some words from Angela Davis, talking about just how broad, you know, working, beginning to work on racism and feminism, looking out to imperialism, capitalism, and the rest. Very exciting stuff. At the top of the hour, sharing some work from Audre Lorde, and yeah, just celebrating on Praxis. FYES is up next, as always, and I will be back next week interviewing Larry Shook about cultural violence, talking about that, talking about militarism, post-traumatic stress, and many other things, but it will be a love theme show for Valentine's Day. Thanks for listening. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.